across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone. I'm the officer of the deck today. We've got some great programs for you. I think you'll find very interesting. We always want to remind you, you can find more about Veterans Radio at its Facebook site or at the web. VeteransRadio.org is our new URL, VeteransRadio.org, where we're on the web 24/7. You can find a lot of our podcasts there as well. We post new ones every Tuesday, so you can get a new story, a new interview, something you didn't know before by going to VeteransRadio.org. And before we get started, we want to thank our sponsors. First up, we want to thank National Veteran Business Development Council, NVBDC.org. It was established to certify both service-disabled and veteran-owned businesses. You'll find out how they can help your business by going to NVBDC.org. We want to thank Legal Help for Veterans. Legal Help for Veterans fights for veterans' disability rights all across the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or on the web at legalhelpforveterans.com. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today two retired Navy officers, Vice Admiral Kevin Green and Captain Bruce Lemkin. Admiral, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thanks very much. Happy to be with you, Jim.
And Captain, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here and good to have my classmate, Admiral Kevin Green, on with us.
Yeah, let me set this up a little bit. Both of these gentlemen graduated from the United States Naval Academy in 1971, and they are both fellows currently with the American College of National Security Leaders. And we have them on not because both of them have really interesting military careers, which we're going to let them describe in brief momentarily, but we really want to talk about the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, which is celebrating its 75th anniversary, and they have some viewpoints on that. So, Admiral, why don't you give us the thumbnail of your military career?
Sure. Again, graduated Naval Academy. I served principally in destroyers during my career and rode on aircraft carriers at sea late in my career, both as a destroyer squadron commander and as a battle group commander. My final military assignment was as the Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Plans, Policy, and Operations, which brought me very close to NATO, which had been a central thread of my career and professional relationships throughout my time in uniform.
Yeah, it's a fascinating career. We could spend the whole time on that. And similarly, Captain Lemkin, Bruce, why don't you tell us about your career in the nuclear submarine field?
Sure. And again, thank you for having us today. I'm an Naval Academy graduate, as well as you said. I was selected by Admiral Rickover to serve in the nuclear submarine program, served in six nuclear submarines, including command of the USS Hyman G. Rickover, Los Angeles-class fast attack submarine, and USS Michigan, then was a Trident ballistic missile submarine. All my shore duty was in the Pentagon, and a lot of time on the Navy staff as well as the joint staff. Retired in 99 and was asked, since I had been negotiating with North Korea, to lead our negotiations on implementing the 1994 agreed framework to dismantle North Korea's nuclear weapons program. That worked out great, didn't it? I then came back into government early in the Bush administration and served through some of the Obama administration for 8.5 years. The last 7 years as the Deputy Undersecretary of the Air Force for International Affairs, I did a lot of work with NATO during that time frame, and while I had done operational work with NATO, most of which I can't talk about when I was a submariner, I was involved in a broad array of support for NATO, both policy and ensuring that NATO had the interoperable aerospace capabilities to partner with us against common threats.
And we have both of you guys on, as I said earlier, you're fellows of the American College of National Security Leaders. Admiral, why don't you tell us what that organization is?
Well, first of all, it's a nonpartisan organization. We don't take a partisan political stance on any of the issues we cover, but we take advantage of the hundreds and hundreds of years of professional experience on the part of our members who are retired generals, admirals, senior defense and State Department officials, including quite a number of ambassadors, who are focused on national security and other critical issues facing the United States. We attend and take part in conferences. We do a lot of writing. We speak as well. And our focus is entirely on the security and future of the United States in a what appears to be an increasingly dangerous world.
Yeah, I think everybody would agree that just on the nightly news, you see how things are getting more dangerous all around the world, whether it's China or Korea or Russia or Ukraine. And that sort of gets us to the central reason we're talking, and that we're approaching the 75th anniversary of NATO. And both of these gentlemen are big thinkers. We're not going to ask them where they graduated at the Naval Academy. You know, I'm sure they were one and two or two and three, but in any event, they're big thinkers. They've got all this great experience. Bruce, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the history of NATO and the what you see as the value of NATO?
Yes, thank you. So NATO was founded 75 years ago, the wake of the end of World War II. And, you know, that was such a huge conflict that required a lot of blood, sweat, tears, national treasure, however you want to put it. And there was a feeling that we needed to ensure this wouldn't happen again. Similar to what we said after World War One, the great war, the war to end all wars, and then lo and behold, 20 years later, we were in World War II. And the rise of the Soviet Union and the Eastern Bloc, the Warsaw Bloc, really provided an incentive for European nations to unite in a for the common defense, and of course we U.S. leadership was essential, and this also was in parallel with the Marshall Plan, where the U.S. did so much to ensure the revival of the economic health of Europe, particularly Western Europe. The military aspect was very important in NATO, and General Eisenhower was the first Supreme Allied Commander of Europe, and the NATO Commander. And NATO has continued to grow. It's continued to demonstrate its relevance and value, and evolve and transform as the situation in the world has changed. Whether it was the demise of the Soviet Union, and then, of course, some time after that, the rise of another adversarial Russia, and also the rise of transnational terrorism and threats throughout the Middle East, and actually, of course, globally. And we are all globally interdependent, whether it's security-wise, defense, economics, etc. So NATO has continued to be relevant, as I said, and its relevance today, I would say, is probably greater than it ever has been. And now we've got 32 members, with the accession of Finland and Sweden into the alliance. And if we can just go back to 9/11, the attack on the terrorist attack on the United States in 2001. Was the first time that Article 5 of the NATO Charter was implemented. An attack on one is an attack on all. Again, I could think of nothing more illustrative of how effective this alliance is.
Well, let me jump in there, because I think that's what, you know, people's knowledge of history is short, and their even memory of the current events is pretty limited. Admiral, when we look at NATO today and the terrorist threats, talk to us a little bit, Kevin, about how valuable it is to have NATO from the viewpoint of the American College of National Security Leaders.
Sure, Jim. Let's just begin with a recognition of a central fact. The primary mission of NATO is collective defense and deterrence against potential aggression against any of its members, wherever those threats occur and exist. When we look at the situation, you mentioned Ukraine. And if you live in Eastern or Central Europe and you're a neighbor to Ukraine, well, pick a country, pick Poland, for example. You find yourself in the role as a first responder in the event that Russia moves further beyond the borders of Ukraine. Russia, if it should threaten the Baltic states, Poland itself, or any of the other countries within the NATO alliance, Poland is truly a first responder. And how do we back up Poland? We back it up with the rest of NATO. We back it up logistically with troops, with weapons, with the whole panoply of capabilities that the NATO nations provide and carry out. We in the United States are far away. It takes some time for us to send materials and troops and so forth, if they're not already in Europe, to be able to respond in the event that an invasion or a movement further western in the western direction takes place. But even more crucially is the issue of deterrence. What's the message to those who would threaten the NATO nations? And that message is NATO is strong, NATO is unified, NATO is ready, NATO is capable, and no attack on the alliance is going to succeed. That's really what this is all about.
So let me bring up a couple of contra issues, I suppose. You only get little snippets of this on the general news. But at times it seems their American leaders complain that everybody in NATO is not carrying their weight in terms of contribution, whether it be financial or military resources. How do you respond to that kind of comment, Captain Lemkin?
Yeah, you know, it depends on how you hold the lights and mirrors on that and how you interpret that. You know, in 2014, NATO established what was really is an aspirational policy that each country strive to commit 2% of its gross domestic product for its military. Not a price of admission, but again, it's a target. This year, 18 of the 31 NATO members are expected to meet that objective. That's a record. But that's just the money aspect. Go back to in the wake of 9/11 and Operation Enduring Freedom and the and ISAF and the International Security Force that was mustered to deal with the terrorist threat that emanated from Afghanistan. Virtually every member of NATO at the time participated and suffered losses. So this wasn't, yes, U.S. paid the greatest price, certainly in terms of our losses, the human losses. That said, this was a collective effort, and just as Admiral Green mentioned, about collective security. And ultimately, that spells deterrence. The mission is to ensure we are ready. We are ready collectively as an alliance, and that will provide a deterrent against any adversary that would attack a NATO member or its interests elsewhere in the world.
Yeah, and we tend to focus just on things going on in Europe. But there are threats all over the world, and being able to work cooperatively with other countries seems extremely important, doesn't it, Admiral Green?
Absolutely. And when we talk about providing security for member nations of NATO, as an alliance, the nation's interests go beyond the military, of course. It goes to the ability to travel and trade and communicate across the globe, and if there are threats that exist somewhere other than the European landmass or the adjoining waters, then absolutely. I mean, we had thousands and thousands of NATO troops in Afghanistan. We had their capabilities across the span of the military systems, programs, and capabilities that they possess. Not anything new about that, really. My initial exposure to NATO was in the summer of 1970 on a West German torpedo boat up in the North Sea, and doing NATO's job in a 135-foot boat against the East Germans and the Soviets and the Poles, and when I would talk with the officers about where are we doing this, it's the point all those years ago was about demonstrating the readiness of NATO, not just the readiness of West Germany, but the readiness of NATO to respond to anything that could be perceived as a threat against the alliance. That point never left my mind.
Well, and Admiral, that requires training and an ability to communicate and cross-country planning. I mean, it's really a big issue to get that degree of cooperation, isn't it?
Absolutely is, and that's why we, within the NATO community, we have officer exchange programs. The ships that I served on had NATO officers from Italy, from Germany, from other countries as well, and we fully man our positions on the NATO staffs, and it is a very smoothly running organization in terms of planning, in terms of political considerations, in terms of readiness, and the technical side as well.
And Captain, it seems to me that you kind of have to look at NATO on the other side of the coin. Some people say the United States ought to be an isolationist, just worry about your own stuff and not everybody else's involvement. But by being in NATO, it's a force multiplier, isn't it, Bruce?
Well, absolutely, and I'm glad you brought this up, because there, our collective memory sometimes is somewhat fuzzy. You know, our fathers, certainly my father, fought in World War II in Europe. Our grandfathers, both my grandfathers, fought in Europe in World War I. And then you look at, so are we going to learn those lessons? NATO deters the next war in Europe, which might not start in Europe. And if deterrence fails, we will not be fighting alone. This also gets to another issue that I've heard people say or address or question. And I've had people say to me, well, why do we have troops in Germany to defend Germany? why can't they defend themselves? Well, as part of the alliance, of course, we're working on our interoperability and our collective security. But there's another aspect. We're over there, so the war does not come over here. We will deter the conflict in Europe just as we do in South Korea and Japan and other areas of the world. So this is, we can't stand alone and survive in what is truly a global world. And that's a lesson that we have to keep reminding ourselves of.
No, I think you're right. And you touched on something I'm going to ask the Admiral to comment on, and that is this idea that a war may start in Europe or may not start in Europe while something's going on over in the Pacific with China and Taiwan or North Korea. You need to be able to have defense and deterrence really all around the world if you're the United States. How does this come into play as you think about it as related to NATO?
Well, I will just repeat something that a former chief of naval operations used to talk about, and that's when asked about the size of the U.S. fleet. He said, well, the fleet of the United States and our allies is about 1,000 ships altogether. The whole notion of fighting alone or deterring alone, probably more importantly, is bankrupt today. We need to work closely with our allies. We need to make sure that they're ready, that we are fully interoperable across the every capability that we have with regard to intelligence, with regard to equipping, with regard to weapon systems, with regard to communications. We need to practice together, and that's true everywhere in the world. There is no better model, however, with regard to peacetime military alliances than NATO. And after all, NATO has been successful for 75 years in doing just that, in deterring major combat in Europe that would spread elsewhere. We have been somewhat less successful in other parts of the world for lack of other kinds of alliances that can be so helpful to us.
Yeah, over time, those alliances and the connections that are made and the bonds that are made, not only between the military members, but also the civilian governments, just get stronger and stronger, doesn't it, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, the ability to communicate, the ability to be interoperable, and that's interoperability is a concept that many people don't understand, and that's understandable because it's not something they have to live with. It's not about being able to talk to one another if you're flying different aircraft or in ships that were manufactured in different places. It's about understanding each other, about training together, operating together. So if you need to, you can fight together as one. And that's what NATO does better than any other arrangement, security arrangement, alliance or otherwise.
Admiral, why don't we wrap up here? You're wearing your hat as a fellow of the American College of Natural Security Leaders. I think Captain Lemkin just gave us a good closing remark from his end, but I'm going to give you an opportunity to do the same.
Well, I thank you, Jim, and all I would say is simply to reiterate that we need to be very thoughtful about the friends that we make, the friends that we value, all of whom have something to contribute to our security. Most people can figure out how to fight a fire. Most people can figure out how to deter a burglar, let's say. But there's nothing like a professional. And the professionals of our NATO partners at the scene of where a conflict could erupt someday is a warming and reassuring thought. We need to be sure that we are the kind of partners that contribute to our joint security, to our combined security, and understand that it is a very dangerous world. It seems to be becoming more dangerous as time goes on. We need to think twice before we decide to look away from those kinds of arrangements and capabilities that are going to protect us and the lives and futures of our children and grandchildren. NATO is part of that.
Well, we really appreciate the time that Vice Admiral Kevin Green and retired and Captain Bruce Lemkin retired from the Navy have given us as fellows of the American College of National Security Leaders to talk about NATO and its 75th anniversary here. Gentlemen, thank you for participating with Veterans Radio today.
Thanks, Jim. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you for the great work that you do, and we appreciate this opportunity.
And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows
by visiting us at veteransradio.org. That's veteransradio.org.
And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.
We again want to thank our national sponsors, the National Veterans Business Development Council, NVBDC.org, VA Ann Arbor Health Care System, the Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, Ann Arbor, Michigan, VFW Graf O'Hara Post 423 in Ann Arbor, and the American Legion Presscorn Post 46, also in Ann Arbor. We appreciate all your support. You can go to veteransradio.net, click on the sponsor level, and continue to support keeping Veterans Radio on the air. And until next time, you are dismissed.